If you like YouTube, you'll love YouTube Premium. Hi, I'm Sean Evans from Hot Ones, and I want to tell you about YouTube Premium. It has offline downloads, so you can watch without Wi-Fi. Background play, so you can lock your phone, and it still plays, baby. Oh, and it is completely ad-free. Yes, I said it, ad-free. Try YouTube Premium for 2 months free at youtube.com/premium. Trial eligibility varies. Terms apply. Cancel anytime.
Labor Day deals are looking good at Lowe's. Save $10 on 1 gallon cans and $50 on 5 gallon pails of select interior paint via rebate. Plus, get two 2.5 quart or 3 quart mums for just $8. A fresh look and savings? Even better. Labor Day deals are on now at Lowe's, in store and online. Valid through 9/9 while supplies last. Mum sizes vary by location and exclude Alaska and Hawaii. See store at Lowe's.com for more details.
John, have you been following the Lindsay Clancy trial?
Yeah, this is the Massachusetts mother accused of killing her 3 kids.
Yeah, I mean, just a sad, tragic story.
Tragic. Absolutely.
And the news coverage has been
intense. It's wall to wall. Like, they're streaming it live all day long. It kind of feels like the OJ case.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? Well, for those who have not been following it, although I assume a lot of our community has been following it because it seems like it's right up their alley, but... Lindsay Clancy is a mother from Duxbury, Massachusetts, and she has admitted to killing her 3 children. This took place on January 24th, 2023. So the dispute is not whether or not she did this crime. The dispute is whether or not she is guilty of this crime. What happened was she, after killing her 3 children, she attempted to kill herself by jumping out of a window. She's since been paralyzed because of that act. And the real thing that's caught everybody's attention is her defense. And like I said, she has admitted to doing this, but claimed that it was that she did this in a state of postpartum psychosis. And that's really what's captured the attention of everyone.
I think. It feels really polarizing where, you know, the media outlets are all over this story. And, you know, there's one side that is saying, you know, we need to have more transparency when it comes to postpartum depression and this called postpartum psychosis. But what is that actually? Maybe we'll just back up. What is postpartum psychosis?
Well, postpartum psychosis, I mean, what she's arguing is that she could not appreciate her actions. She's claiming the insanity defense.
Yeah.
Postpartum psychosis is Lindsay Clancy's claim is that she, after she had birthed, she had 3 kids, and after she had birthed, she entered into a long period of postpartum depression, and that escalated into a literal psychosis in which she was hearing voices and seeing things,
right?
And that was the reason that she did this.
I had read though too, she didn't hear voices before the crime. Well, before the deaths, let's say.
Before the deaths, yeah.
She heard them while she was performing the act, but she didn't hear them after either. So it's like people are kind of questioning that.
Yeah, and actually that's really what's grabbed my attention is not the details of the case, like when she heard the voices. It's the Grand Canyon size gulf between what the prosecution is trying to prove and what the defense is trying to prove. And what I mean is the legal system has a definition of sanity that doesn't really map on to our understanding of how the mind works. And that's because the legal system, the definition of sanity was developed in the 1840s and neuroscience didn't come into popular culture until the 1980s. So the questions that the prosecutor is asking, things like, when did you hear the voices, the intent, you know, when did you gain knowledge of the crime? These are like very crude questions in understanding the neuroscience of postpartum depression and psychosis. And the defense is asking much different questions. They're asking things like when, you know, they're talking about neurochemicals and a trajectory of this illness, looking at things like impulse control. And those are very different questions. And it just really illustrates how the legal system's theory of psychology is so outdated.
Right.
You know?
And then she did see counseling, you know, ahead of this event. Mm-hmm. And she even was, admitted herself to a psychiatric hospital ahead. So she was trying to work through it, it sounds like.
Yeah, and all those things speak to the reality of mental illness and the reality of postpartum depression and psychosis, is that it doesn't take place kind of in one moment. It's a long trajectory of illness. And again, that is coming to a head with the legal system that wants to look at specific moments and ask kind of blunt questions, right, to try and determine culpability. But, you know, to me, it just speaks to the whole idea that you need massive reform in the justice system. And we should really do away with the insanity defense. Not that that shouldn't be on an option for someone like Lindsay Clancy, but we need to have a different way of adjudicating these cases.
With one other thing that I read too is like 1 in 7 women experience postpartum depression. So it's something that I know, you know, either you know someone or you've had, you know, someone in your life that's experienced that. But so I think it's something, and maybe that's why it's become such a polarizing thing. So because people are, they can recognize that this is, or some version of this postpartum depression has happened in their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, the idea that, you know, I think most of us, if not all of us, have known someone who's experienced postpartum depression. It's a very real thing. And the idea that the legal system treats postpartum depression and cannibalism the same way, that those are both the insanity defense. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that's a bit, like, a bit of a
why can we not
there?
Have more nuance?
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So I think closing arguments are happening this week. So I guess we'll probably know maybe next week, and maybe we can hit on this again as to, you know, what the verdict may be. It is a jury trial, so it might take a minute. Okay. So moving on, this week we released an episode on Bruce MacArthur. And for those of you that don't know, or maybe haven't heard the episode yet, James Buddy Day was the, what would you be called? The showrunner, producer, director?
For the Bruce MacArthur documentary? Yeah. I directed a documentary in, come out 2021?
It was during COVID, yeah.
I know we filmed it during COVID. I remember, distinctly remember filming it during COVID. But it came out in 2021, I think. It's called Catching a Serial Killer, Bruce MacArthur. I did see some comments on YouTube asking us where to find it. I know we're in Canada, so I know it's on Crave in Canada. And in the States, I believe it's on Peacock. We made it with, it was Oxygen at the time, owned by NBC at the time. So I assume it's on Peacock, but I know you can rent it on Prime Video.
Also, it just kind of brings up some memories of production, mm-hmm, making documentaries during COVID. When you worked on this, you were in your cohort.
That's right. Right, cohort. I forgot all about that.
Right. Yeah. So maybe give me one memory from of filming this during COVID.
A lot of memories. I mean, we filmed a lot of it outside. How that documentary came to be was I was at home doing nothing. I was COVID had shut down the entertainment industry at that time. I remember I was at home like working out when my phone rang, I like a gym in my basement, and it was NBC, and they said, "Hey, do you think you could make a documentary in these circumstances?" Because everyone was trying to get back into production at that time. Yeah. And they said, "Well, we have a documentary in development, and it's about Bruce MacArthur in Toronto. Would you be willing to get on a plane and go to Toronto?" That was the question.
Right.
Because at the time, I mean, they were flying, but
it was pretty much lockdown, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. And so I said, sure. I wasn't doing anything.
You were working out, though. You were getting ripped.
Yeah.
I wish I could say I was doing that. I was not.
It was the time in COVID, like right at the beginning, when everybody was home. Like my whole family was home. And so I got on a plane. I remember it was really weird. It was the first time I had ever flown since COVID. And, you know, you had to wear gloves and mask. It was intense. And I went to Toronto, and I rented an apartment near the Village, and I stayed there for the whole summer, and we made that documentary. And then I came back home and we edited it. But how we filmed it was the restaurants were closed down, so we actually rented a restaurant because no one else was using it.
And it couldn't be open, probably?
Yeah, it couldn't be open. And then we built pathways through the restaurant, and each pathway led to a different interview location. So you would walk in a door and it looked like a maze, and then you would follow the pathway, and then you would go to like A or B or C, and you'd walk in and there'd be an interview set up there. And so we had everyone just come one at a time into the restaurant and then go through the maze, and that's how we kept everybody separated.
I remember going to the airport, maybe in 2020, like maybe before, maybe in June, and we were flying, and it was myself, my camera guy Nate, and camera guy Phil. And it was us and the cleaning staff in the whole departure wing. In
really?
The international. Yeah, yeah, it was like the cleanest place you could ever imagine, and no place to eat. No, mm-hmm. you know, nobody's there, you know. And I always think about, boy, I wish I would have taken a photo, you know.
Yeah.
To capture that moment of like that you could never, ever recreate, you know.
One thing was we drove up to MacArthur's. Where he grew up, like the area where he grew up, which is outside of Toronto. It's about an hour or so outside of Toronto.
Right.
And it's all farmland.
I was going to say it's farming.
Yeah, it's farmland. Yeah. And because it was COVID, you know, everything was shut down. So everyone was outside. So
right.
It was really easy to talk to people. And that's how I got to meet a lot of people that knew him.
Okay. So a lot of the comments on the Bruce MacArthur episode, they surround about how was this person in plain sight for years and years and years. And it reminded me of a couple of stories that we've done on Unmarked already on Robert Picton
mm-hmm.
and Paul Bernardo. You can find those on our Unmarked pages. And very similar, that the police knew who these people were for years, interviewed them, and decided they weren't a threat. So
mm-hmm.
why do you think, I guess that's the question is, you know, these predators, they were interviewed but dismissed by police. But why? Why?
I definitely see the comparisons to Picton. I mean, MacArthur and Bernardo were obviously in the same city. Police dismissed Bernardo because he just fooled them. You know, he was a psychopath and he fooled them. But I definitely see the comparisons between MacArthur and Picton. Because in both cases, in Picton's case, the Vancouver police, and in MacArthur's case, the Toronto police, in both cases, you have a marginalized, a vulnerable population. In Picton's case, you have sex workers in the downtown east side. In MacArthur's case, you have South Asian and gay immigrant men in the gay village in Toronto. And in both cases, those communities were going to the police saying, something's happening. There's a serial killer. People are going missing. And in both cases, talk to this guy.
Right. Yeah.
In both cases, the community had identified the person. On Sunday, if you're on our RSS feed or our YouTube channel, we interviewed a MacArthur survivor named Mark Henderson, who encountered MacArthur almost 10 years before he was arrested.
Right.
And told the police, this guy's dangerous. And MacArthur had attacked him. He's a MacArthur survivor.
Right.
So yeah, definitely in Picton's case and MacArthur's case, you see, you know, the police just completely ignoring the serial killer. And then, so the question is why would the police do that? And I mean, this is a great question. I mean, why do the police not want to ever believe there's a serial killer in their midst? In Picton's case, it was because the police completely dismissed the sex workers as less than human, as nomadic. And in the Toronto case, they dismissed the men, the victims, because they were gay. So I mean, bigotry definitely in the Toronto case. I'm not exactly sure what you call it. In the Picton case, maybe it is bigotry because they were, most of them were Indigenous.
They were First Nation, yeah.
But I mean, it's always a good case. And you see this over and over and over again in serial killer cases. The police never want to believe there's a serial killer. Why do you think?
I always think about something that we talked about in another show. And it was about it's hard to find someone that doesn't have an address. You know, if you don't have an address that you collect your taxes, how do you find this person? So like in mm-hmm. Vancouver, a lot of these women, the police dismissed them because they're like, well, she probably moved.
But I think that's the problem, because the police assumed that the women didn't have addresses. They assumed they were nomadic. But actually, when you dig into the victims, like consider the Picton case, when you dig into those victims, they weren't nomadic. They had kids. They got their, you know, those communities were where they got their drugs and their methadone and also that's where their friends and family lived. Like, you know, just because they were sex workers and struggling with addiction didn't mean an indigenous. It didn't mean that they were nomadic. And I think that's the problem.
There's an assumption there, right?
There's an assumption that this person doesn't have an address.
Right.
And therefore, they're probably just not here.
Or maybe they've moved a couple of times in the last couple of years, so the trail is it's harder to trace.
It becomes a convenient excuse for a very overworked police department.
Yeah, totally. Right?
You know, and all these police departments are facing resource problems, and they all need more officers, and they all need more time. But assuming the victim is just a runaway, you see this in every serial killer case, but assuming the victim is a runaway or just has just left, they're not actually missing, it clears the case, they can move on to something else.
And I just wanted to follow up. In Toronto, a lot of them, at least some of the victims were new Canadians that were maybe undocumented, so police were thinking they were just kind of underground because they didn't
That was only, I think that only applies to one case. There was one of the victims was an asylum seeker who was denied and ordered to be deported,
right.
And they believed he had gone underground. In fact, his family believed that as well, but he hadn't. He had been killed by MacArthur.
Okay, I want to just move on here. We could talk about MacArthur. We'll maybe talk about him more in the coming weeks as we get more comments and questions, but I want to move to the Brian Kohberger episode.
Oh, back to Brian
Kohberger.
Yeah,
the Ohio murders. This is an episode we did a couple weeks ago.
Continues to fuel a lot of discussion.
Again, we were talking about something that's very polarizing, and this is one of those cases as well.
Yeah.
One of the questions was, this is from YouTube, and the question was it ever explained why the survivors in the house waited several hours before they called police?
Yeah, I don't think you could say it's been explained, but it's been discussed, and they've offered an explanation. And so just to catch up everyone who hasn't seen the Brian Kohberger episode, the murder took place in the middle of the night, essentially. The time is...
It's 4 in the morning.
Was it 4 in the morning?
Yeah.
Okay. It took place at 4 in the morning, and it happened over about 9 minutes. There were 6 people in the house. He killed 4. One of the survivors did see him as he was exiting. And then that survivor was so terrified, she ran down to the room of the other survivor and they locked the door, and then they didn't call police for 8 hours. And the question is, why didn't they call police for 8 hours? And this has been debated, and this has been held up as evidence of some sort of conspiracy.
Conspiracy, yeah.
Which I think is unfortunate. In my mind, it's a simple explanation. You have 2 college age women. They're in a house. It's 4 in the morning. They've all been drinking. They've been partying. It is a house where they are not unused to seeing other strangers in the hallway,
right,
in the middle of the night that they don't know, because they have many roommates. They're at college. People come and go. So the fact that one of the survivors saw someone in the house is, you think, well, why wouldn't you call the police right away? But that's not in this context, it wasn't all that, it was unusual, but not all that unusual. It could be explained. It's like, well, maybe Maddie had someone over, maybe Kaylee had someone over. So I don't know. The idea that a college woman of that age would kind of see something and then get freaked out and then run down to her roommate, and her roommate's like, you know what? I don't think anything's happening. I mean, I don't think 2 college age roommates in the basement are going to assume, well, a serial killer must have come into the house and killed everybody.
Yeah. And if I remember correctly, it wasn't the police that they called. It was a friend that came over first, and he called the police.
Yeah. They called a friend and he came over, and then, you know, saw the aftermath and called the police immediately.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it was naive of them, but I think you can attribute it to their age and the circumstances.
Yeah, it's hard to blame
I don't
them,
think
though,
it's that weird.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it's, I don't think I, it's weird. I don't think it's that weird in terms of it implies a conspiracy.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying
to say. Yeah, 100%. 100%. And they kind of have to live with that decision too, right?
Yeah. You got to filter. I mean, they're, you know, we're talking about living people. I mean,
yeah.
I don't fault them for this decision. I don't think any of this is their fault. It's Brian Kohberger's fault.
Yeah, 100%. Okay. Moving on, Gary Ridgway. We did an episode on Gary.
Gary Ridgway.
And the Green River killings, maybe about a month ago. And somebody had a good question, and it was, again, this is from YouTube, and it's Patricia Madsen. She said, how did his brothers turn out? And it kind of led to a bigger question is, why do siblings of serial killers have somewhat normal lives? Like, Jeffrey Dahmer's brother, pretty normal guy. But then I think about, Hayden Clark, his brother, not such a nice guy. So like, where's the tipping point, I guess, is the question.
So I think we're talking about two questions here. The first question is, why doesn't everyone who grows up in the same environment become a serial killer? And the second question is, how is it that the siblings of serial killers are also not serial killers or psychopaths?
Can just normalize.
And, I mean, there's overlap between these questions, but the answer to this, it can be found in the literature. And when you look at people, children specifically, who are exposed to violence and trauma, the overwhelming majority of them do not grow up to be violent.
Right.
The number of the kids who are exposed to extreme trauma and grow up to be violent or grow up to be serial killers is by far the outlier. It's a small, small, small fraction of kids. And I think that tells us a lot. And what it tells us is when you grow up in trauma, you actually internalize victimhood and you learn, you get used to bad relationships. And what we see with kids who are exposed to trauma in the research is that when they grow up, they end up, they're very much more likely to be victims of trauma themselves.
Right.
Rather than kind of perpetuate the violence.
Yeah.
And that speaks to the idea that in order to become a violent offender or be a serial killer, you have to have another ingredient. And that ingredient is something I talk about all the time. That's neurological vulnerability. And what I mean is your mind has to be open to it. You have to have the underpinnings of psychopathy or something, or malignant narcissism or something. You have to have a mind that is fixated inward, that struggles to attach to other people. You know, this cannot be taught to you. You have to have it going in. Now, you have to have that, and you have to have trauma. You have to have both of those things.
Right.
So, if you grow up in a terrible household and you have this kind of mind that looks inward and you're kind of going down that psychopathy pathway, it's not strange that your sibling who doesn't have that kind of mind doesn't.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. And psychopathy is only 50 to 60% hereditable.
Right.
So, you know, if you have four kids, maybe one or two of them might show indicators of that, but the other two are going to be fine. They're going to be normal in terms of neurologically normal.
Right. Okay. Okay. Last question. We did a series this summer about the serial killers in Long Island. And for those of you that don't know, the three that we covered were Joel Rifkin, Robert Shulman, Richard Cottingham. And the one that we have not covered is Rex Heuermann.
And John Bitroff. We haven't covered. We're not quite done. I'm not done with that.
Fair. Okay. Okay.
There's other Long Island serial killers we're looking at.
I think about in the comments, and there's a lot of them, and people are trying to explain the why. Like, why does Long Island create these kinds of people?
Well, that's what we're trying to find out in that series, I guess. We have a series on YouTube. It's called The Long Island Serial Killers. And the Long Island serial killer has long been a cold case that's gone on for decades, and it's formed Reddit communities, and it's formed documentaries and all sorts of things. And then when Rex Heuermann was arrested, people began to call him the Long Island serial killer, or Lisk.
Yeah.
But what we've since come to realize, you know, and this is very recent,
that
Lisk is not one person. It's many people. So what we're trying to do on Unmarked is we're trying to do deep dives on all these men and try and answer this question.
Find a correlation.
What are the correlations? And there are a lot of correlations between these men. I think one of the big things we're seeing is that geography is playing a big role. And what I mean is that Long Island is unique in that it's, most of it is a suburban community.
Right.
And you can live there with a family, and then you can get in your car and you can get to East Side Manhattan and Brooklyn and
Very Hell's densely Kitchen. Populated.
Yeah. And historically, those areas have been a hive for sex work. That's where the strolls have been, especially in the 80s and 90s during the cocaine and crack epidemic. So, so what we're seeing is that geography is playing a big role in that if you have psychopathic men living in Long Island, there's a lot of opportunity for them to access vulnerable populations
and go right back.
And I mean, geographic profiling would have solved that case, the Rex Humorant case anyway, very quickly, but they didn't use it.
What about pop culture? How much does that kind of play into this?
That's a great question. It's something I've really noticed.
Because although, like, it seems like, I mean, maybe not Rex Humorant, but they kind of modeled themselves after Joel Rifkin specifically.
Yeah, Joel Rifkin, right.
Modeled themselves after, you know, things that they saw in movies.
Yeah, Joel Rifkin, like, as an example, really enjoyed the movie Silence of the Lambs.
Great.
And Silence of the Lambs has had a huge influence over the phenomenon of serial murder. But Joel Rifkin used to watch Silence of the Lambs, and he would watch. You remember the scene with Jodie Foster when she sees the dead body for the first time and they find the moth?
And she's kind
of a young agent, and she goes in, she's almost like taken aback by the smell. And then her boss, who's the head of the FBI mm-hmm. kind of agent in charge, gives her Noxzema to put under her nose. Yep. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do.
When Joel Rifkin was arrested, he had Noxzema under his nose, and he said he got that from watching Silence of the Lambs.
Right.
And he would watch not just Silence of the Lambs, he'd watch other things. He studied the Green River Killer because a book called The Green River Killer came out right before he started killing people. And he would watch movies like, I can't remember. He would list all these movies. And we saw that kind of behavior in Jeffrey Dahmer, was really interested in The Exorcist 3. And there was another movie there. But yeah, the confluence between serial killing and pop culture is there for sure. I feel like I'm just starting to understand it, but it comes up a lot.
Okay. I'm just going to sneak in one more question because sure. I liked it. And this is from Mr. Cyril's a lot. And the question was, which serial killer would you hang with if you choose both in and out of prison?
Both in and out of prison? That was a real question.
Yeah, that's a question. Yeah, 100%. I thought that was good. Yeah.
What serial killer would I hang with in or out of prison? In prison, I mean, a serial killer that I would want to meet, living or dead? Are we going to say living or dead?
Well, yeah, you just decide. Just
like, who would I want to sit with?
Yeah, who would you want to kind of converse with and kind of maybe get to know them?
I mean, in terms of sitting with, I mean, Ted Bundy is obviously a really fascinating killer, except the problem with Ted Bundy.
The conversation would be good with him, too.
Well, no, but he won't tell you anything. Like, that's
the
problem.
No, but he
kind
of tells
Bundy.
You what you want to hear, so he's a bit
Yeah,
of a
but
mirror.
You're not gleaning any information from him. I'm trying to think of an interesting serial killer who I'd want.
Who would be, yeah, who's going to be honest, though?
I think, yeah, like a younger Ed Kemper.
Yeah, it's funny because that's what I was like. Yeah, I think maybe Ed Kemper because he seems like he would be
insightful.
Yeah, or like thoughtful. Yeah.
The problem I have with serial killer interviews, and I've watched.
I knew you were going to say
countless serial killer interviews, is that the people who, the law enforcement officials who approach serial killers, they never approach them correctly. I think if you want to get information out of a serial killer, you have to approach them from their perspective. And you have to ask them things like questions about how they perceived their childhood, you know, how they perceived their parents, who they were able to attach to and who they were not able to attach to. When did they discover that they were a psychopath? And how did that impact them? When did the impulses start? When did the fantasies start? What were the fantasies? Where did they come from? Though you have to kind of start there. And law enforcement never, ever asks these questions. They always start at the body. They're always like, where were you on the night of the 14th? You know? And that is so late. And that's because law enforcement always approaches these interviews from their own perspective. And all they're concerned about is solving the murders. But you would solve the murders and more if you just backed up and allowed these psychopaths, you know, kind of indulge their world,
right?
And not just their world, indulge their trajectory, and like saw it through their eyes, and we just never see that. I mean, sometimes you'll find a really good, an interrogation. The Detective Jim Smith's interrogation of
right.
Russell Williams,
yeah, quite good.
Actually, does this and brilliantly.
Yeah, he was good. I think about an episode that we did on John Wayne Gacy and his lawyer.
Mm-hmm. And Karen Conti.
Yeah, Karen Conti told the story about how every time she met John Wayne Gacy, it was felt like she was starting over.
Yeah.
It was like the first time she'd ever met him every time. And is that because, you know, psychopaths can't form attachments or...
Partially. Yeah. What she was speaking about was, and I've talked to her about this since, was John Wayne Gacy, yes, he definitely couldn't form attachments, but it speaks to how superficial he was.
Right.
So she would sit with him and he would brag.
And he was super nice to her.
And be really and like, nice and do all this.
Yeah.
But he was not attached to her in any way. So it didn't form any emotional memories for him. And everything he was doing was very superficial and in the moment. And when she left the cell, when she left his presence, he went on to the next person. So when she came back to her, it felt like he had no memory of their interaction.
Of their conversations from before.
But it's not that he couldn't remember. It's that it wasn't advantageous to him to remember. There was no benefit to him to remember that interaction. That he interacted with everyone as if it was super meaningful and you know... And they were connecting, but he didn't connect with anyone. So
okay. So if you have a question for the show that you want us to answer, I want you to leave it in the comments on YouTube or Apple Podcast, or better yet, you can DM us on Instagram at Unmarked Podcast, or finally, you can hit up Buddy directly at James Buddy Day on Instagram. Send him a note, and maybe your question will be on the show. So until next week, thanks for listening.